Good morning, world diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And hello, Peter.
Hello, good morning, good morning. And what are we doing today? Well, we've got one of the leaders, undoubtedly acknowledged leaders of the world of the culinary world on the program this morning.
Ruth, luminary in the extreme, actually.
A luminary, okay. And we had a chance to talk to her about the way she sees the world now.
And she's so thoughtful. I'm just enormously impressed with
her. We're talking, of course, about Ruth
Reichel.
Mm-hmm. Is she the publisher or the
editor-in-chief
of Gourmet
magazine?
Before that, she was the dining critic for New York Times.
Yeah,
a rather powerful position. I think before that she was in Los Angeles.
I think we talk about that in the interview.
The neat part about it is that she's always thinking about what's next.
Well, Miss Ann has wanted to talk with Ruth Reichel for years. I've been a big fan of her, and we found out we have something in common. We both have masters in art history from the University of Michigan.
And of course, you're both practicing exactly what you preach.
Exactly.
do a master's in art history, and then ask, would you like fries with that, sir?
Well, you know, there are others too, Ruth. I don't know what the association is between the visual arts and cooking. I do know what it is, basically, but anyhow, let's figure out. I mean, there's so many things we could talk about. You are editor-in-chief of Gourmet magazine, which is probably the most prestigious or one of the most prestigious positions to be in. Your background is so rich with having been the restaurant critic for the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times. You're on every board and culinary board in the world. From your position, you can see what's going on. And you said in a previous conversation that you were shifting slightly the focus of Gourmet magazine to meet what you consider to be the major issues in the culinary world today. Could you just talk a little bit about what you're doing at the magazine and what you think these big issues are right now?
Well, I think the first issue is I think people really need help cooking. I mean, the economy, we've been in a sort of restaurant economy where everybody was interested in the hot new thing and the new trend. And, now we're in trouble here. And I think that people are going to go back to cooking, and they need to know how to cook. I mean, I think a lot of people don't know how to cook anymore, and we're going to do a lot of basic encouraging people to cook. Our October issue has a big thing about butcher cuts and how to use these less expensive cuts of meat. I feel like this is a time for people who cook to rejoice that, you know, the upside of all of this trouble that the economy is in is a kind of return to the kitchen and to basic values. And I feel like for people who love to cook, this is the time to go out to people and say, you know, this is really great. Come back into the kitchen, feed your family, spend time with your kids growing food. Let's look at the positive side of this bad time that we're in. And so we're really spending a lot of time thinking about, you know, what is it that we can do to help our readers live richer, better lives.
Now, you also mentioned that there's a new ethics issue coming up to the fore.
Right. Well, we have spent a lot of time at Gourmet. When I first came to Gourmet 10 years ago, when I went to the staff and said, you know, we have a mandate to change the magazine, what should we be doing? And every one of us felt that the important thing was to start talking about where our food comes from and to talk about the farmers and to talk about problems that, you know, with the ecology and the environment, and to really try and connect people to the earth in a way that Epicurean magazines just didn't do. And we have done that to such an extent we used to do a special what we called a produce issue, and then suddenly we realized that there was no point in doing that anymore because it was so much a part of our DNA that we were doing it in every issue.
Right.
And now I feel like everybody is aware of problems in the food supply and understands that, you know, the farmers are important to us and farmers have become big heroes.
Celebrity people, farmers now.
Celebrity farmers, absolutely. And people, you know, really understand that they're, you know, that the ecology matters and that we have to think about green issues. But I think that what's getting ignored a lot in this is the people who, the workers, the issues of fairness in food. I mean, we understand that there's an obesity crisis and that that is partly a class issue in eating. But there are still real issues about the people who pack our meat and pick our tomatoes. And we really need to start thinking about how important it is that at every step along the food chain, there be an issue of fairness, and we're going to be start paying attention to
now,
that.
How do you marry that with the fact that unfortunately, if people in the food supply business get paid more money, then what's going to happen is the price of food is going to go up, and that's a sort of a counterproductive thing for today.
Well, it that goes back to the issue of learning to cook. I mean, I think one of the things that is, I think one of the reasons that we're in trouble is that we think that food should be cheap, and you know, we pay less, a smaller percentage of our incomes for food than almost anybody else in the world. Food isn't cheap.
Like, and Michael Pollan says, pay more, eat less.
Well, I mean, that's right, and you know, I mean, it comes back, ultimately. All of the cheap food that we have has a cost. And, you know, it's a cost in obesity and sickness, and there are social costs to it. And I think we have to start thinking of it in a bigger picture, and we have to start thinking maybe we don't have to eat meat at every meal. Maybe we have to learn to cook unprocessed food, because a lot of the cost of food is in the processing, and it goes back to learning to cook.
So you're thinking that it would be important to push people back to saying, eat things that are in season. Don't expect to have a good tomato in January, and just stop eating them until such time as you can buy them at the New York Green Market again?
Exactly, and learn to eat the things that, I mean, we eat so high on the food chain.
Oh, it's terrible.
We don't eat what we consider trash fish. You know, we only eat, you know, the fish that have eaten all the little fish. Well, maybe it's time for us to start learning to eat the little fish, learning to cook the less fancy cuts of meat, learning, going back to offal, which
we eat a lot of that, actually.
Yeah, we love it. We love all those special
parts.
Peter's
English, like, you know, they grow up
like,
with that.
Like tongues and livers and kidneys and that kind of thing. And the difficulty is that it's hard to get those in the food chain. In fact, we buy beef liver, frozen beef liver from Whole Food Market, and I'm not sure that they intend it for human consumption,
because it's right next to the
dog food.
Yes.
Well, I mean, it was fascinating to me to do this article about eating inexpensively in Paris.
Oh, right.
And I went over and, you know, did this and was eating in restaurants of these wonderful young chefs who are trying to serve food at a really affordable price. And what you end up eating are, you know, wonderful pig's ear salads and a tartare of beets and wonderful, you know, calves brains. And these are menu items that you just don't find in this country. And they're wonderful.
Because they wouldn't sell in this country without a lot of education.
No, they wouldn't sell now, but once people are educated, perhaps they will sell in the future. I mean, what do you think about this suggestion, Ruth? It's, you know, people have been moaning about gasoline getting to $4 a gallon, and you and I both know, and Anne knows without realizing quite so much, that when you go to Europe, it's quite possible to live in a civilized fashion with gas or petrol or whatever you like to call it, $12 a gallon, and food is probably, you know, not the same degree higher, but it's certainly a whole lot higher than it is here, and civilization doesn't stop.
No, it changes. Mm-hmm. And it changes in a good way. And, you know, I think that the upside of this crisis is that we are going to have to start living more thoughtfully.
Now, do you see this happening in the restaurant scene as well? We did see that in London. There's a couple of wonderful guys who have two restaurants, one called Arbutus and the other called, what's it called? Wild honey. And they told us, they said, we built our cuisine around inexpensive cuts of meat and things that are in season, and our objective was to keep everything on the menu for lunch. Now, it might sound like a horrendous amount of money anyway, but anything on the menu less than £15 for an entree, and we haven't seen that in the U.S. yet. Do you think we will?
Oh, I absolutely think we will. I think you're going to see inventive young chefs doing exactly what you see in London and Paris. And I think it's going to become a badge of honor for people who now say, oh, I love hot food and I'll eat anything. And to come back to, okay, eating anything means not just eating, you know, that far out Chinese dish, but, you know, eating things that their grandparents ate.
Right. Pickled watermelon rind is coming back. I said to my husband.
I don't know about pickled watermelon rind.
I grew up on it. My grandmother always made pickled watermelon rind.
I mean, you can pickle just about anything, but that would not be close to the top of my list.
I mean, you are seeing it a little bit with, I mean, pork belly.
Oh, yeah.
Which
well,
is the chicest dish in New York right now.
Oh, it's been in London for ages now.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, 5 years ago, yeah, you wouldn't have found that on any menu in America.
No, you should have seen Anne and Peter tucking into a plate of charcuterie at tambourine in Bologna. every piece fatter than the next, and we ate the whole thing.
Oh, well. But, you know, Ruth, I think that the thing that's most startling to people is that we used to think of food issues as being something in underdeveloped countries, and we never thought of it as relating to our own situation. And now we've had so many food scares, and we've had such, as you said, an obesity problem, and the economy is so rotten. It's all coming home, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, one of the ironies of we think of food issues as being in underdeveloped countries. In fact, those people who we used to think had food issues are, for the most part, eating more healthfully
right
than people in our own country.
Right. Did you ever read this book called The Jungle Effect?
No. Oh, it's the health book.
Yeah.
Yes, I have it sitting here on my desk.
Well, it's about native diets and so forth, including the Amazon.
Yeah, the book I'm the most excited about right now, although I'm having a little bit of trouble getting through it, partly because I actually know the author. I used to play squash with him. This is by a guy called Dr. David Servan-Shriver, who at age 35 discovered he had a brain tumor. And not only that, he later had a recurrence of it as well. But he looks at food from a health perspective and says one of the reasons that maybe I got sick and a lot of people get sick is because of all this horrible stuff we ingest. And
David does that, huh?
Oh, yes. He's got a whole diet section on these are the things to avoid, and these are the things you should concentrate on, which will give your body the best possible chance of being healthy.
I mean, it's interesting. We have an article in our November issue about a guy named Mark Castell, who runs the Cornucopia Alliance, which is an organic watchdog group, and he came to that because he was selling big farm machinery, and he got very, very sick and found out that he was deathly allergic to pesticides.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Ruth, I think we can't let you go in the position where you know, some people might suggest you rule the world of food in America almost as much as Martha Stewart does. if we didn't get you to tell us about some of your favorite new places to dine, anywhere in the world, because on the menu, listeners are tuning in from everywhere. So where are some places that are top of your list right now, things you're really excited about?
Well, I'm here in New York, I'm really excited by the food of David Chang, who has a restaurant. He has a few restaurants. One's Momofuku, and
you can't get into.
He has a little 12-seat one.
Yeah,
but the regular Momofuku,
yeah,
you can get
there
into.
We were there. Yeah.
And Sambar, and I love this food, and I think it sort of points to the fact that I think, you know, one of the next, he is Korean American, and his food is sort of inflected with this Korean aesthetic, and I think Korean food is going to come into its own internationally. People are going to start discovering that this is This is a really exciting cuisine that has, for reasons I don't understand, been totally overlooked.
People said that Indian, real Indian, regional Indian food was going to be the next big wave, but I haven't seen that.
Yeah, I guess the tip for listeners is go early and go at lunchtime to Momofuku. That's exactly what we did, and we were able to get in. Otherwise, it's rather frustrating because there's nowhere exactly around the corner that you can go.
Exactly. But, the food is just, inventive and exciting, and it's sort of where restaurants are right now, which is very casual. You're sitting at a counter, basically.
Now, if you want Ruth's input on Paris, she just published it, all you have to do is get on the website or buy a magazine. But what about another corner of the world?
Well, I just have to say, in Paris, this restaurant, La Mijon, I just loved. The food was boisterous and exciting, and you feel like you're, in the beating heart of Paris.
That's what we love, yeah.
And the duck, just the flavor just resonates in your mouth, goes on and on and on. In London, I am a huge fan of Fergus Henderson's food.
We had him do it. We were at the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival.
I did an interview with him. I tell you what, he is one brave man. He got up and did a cooking demonstration, subsequently I interviewed him, and he's struggling with a health issue which he doesn't even talk about, and it's just amazing.
And his food is simple, straightforward, from the earth. He's known for his marrow salad, but I had the best asparagus I've ever had in my life there.
Oh, really?
And just, very simple, but these perfect, perfectly cooked, just picked asparagus. And that is just, it's thrilling to eat food that just, tastes of the earth.
Right. I had his roasted pig's tail, and I can honestly say that one of those in my whole lifetime was enough.
And unfortunately, he was also presenting a dish of pig's head, and there was half a pig's head on every table. And I'm afraid the kitchen at the hotel where the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival was didn't really have much of a clue as to how to cook pig's heads. So it came out looking rather underdone and not very attractive at all, and nobody at our table ate any.
I was in Melbourne a few months ago, and I loved the food in Australia.
We lived in Australia in the 70s, and believe me, you would not have loved the food there. It was English hotel food or stuffy French. That was it.
But now it's absolutely
now
terrific.
Now it's wonderful.
Oh, it's just, I loved Melbourne. I loved the people there.
Well, we lived just a little bit south of Melbourne.
Yeah, in a region that didn't even grow grapes when I lived there, and now they have some of the best wines in the world coming out of vineyards that are right next to the golf course.
What restaurants did you hit in Melbourne, Ruth?
I
always forget things too.
The wonderful new Greek restaurant was the place.
Oh, those Greek guys, we actually never got there.
we had a little bit of problem. We had a little bit of problem with that. Isn't it called the Press Club?
Yes, it is called the Press Club.
Yeah, we had a little bit of difficulty because the owner was kind of tied up. The place we absolutely love to put down on your list for next time you go is Donovan's. Donovan's right on the back of the beach in St. Kilda. Gail is a major health problem recovery person, and her husband, curiously enough, was born in the United States, and they both were in the hotel business. And now they run this absolutely wonderful restaurant called, and if you want the website, it's eatatdonovans.com.
Yeah. Oh, well, that's...
gives you an idea of what they have in mind.
And she has did a wonderful book called How to Walk a Dog in Italy. Anyhow, we're moving into another phase of this discussion, this conversation with you. I appreciate the time you've given us, and I loved talking to you.
This has been really fun.
Oh, well.
please come back and see us when you have some more interesting subjects that you'd like to talk to us about, and I know our listeners will be fascinated.
Well, I think she already came up with a title for a new book. We've got to learn to eat little fishes.
We do.
Anyhow, thanks, Ruth.
Thank you.
And good luck with your progress.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And now we'll take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. Please email us onthemenu@onthemenuradio.com
or join our blog.
Come blog with us. We just started a blog.
On the Menu Radio at blogspot. I said it right this time.
Yes.
.com.
Yeah.
We'll get in touch with us, and hopefully we'll get some fascinating conversations going. And in the meantime, of course, back to Virginia, an amazing estate.
With
22 wonderful rooms, a spa, a fabulous restaurant, in a building that's been extant for a couple of hundred years or so. A very special experience with the chef owner.
On the Menu goes from one wonderful place to the next in Southern Virginia, and we're currently at Poplar Springs, the Inn and Spa, talking to the proprietor and executive chef, Howard Foer, as in Tiger Woods, Peter said. Howard, hello. Give us a welcome again.
Welcome to Poplar.
This guy is so swell. I mean, he's really from Washington, D.C. He brings a whole different aesthetic to this place, which is probably one of the most expansive and beautiful properties we've seen on this trip. Could you give us a little history, Howard, of this property?
I'd be glad to give you history of the property. Poplar Springs, we're just under 200-acre property that we purchased back in 1995, me and my wife. Being in the catering industry since 1987, we just needed a little more to focus on, I believe, which has made life a little complicated. We purchased the property in 1995, and then with a little extra wine and a little extra help, we decided to build our inn and spa that we opened up in the end of 2002. And that's where we are today. And 6 years later, we're sitting here.
Now, it's rather incredible that when was this property built? And you are what number of owner? It has a really interesting history and not a big change of hands. And while I'm asking you this, how much restoration did you have to do?
We purchased the property in 1995, and we purchased it from Robin Cutler. And she inherited it from her mother, who died here in 1988, who was adopted by her aunt and uncle. When she was 16, she moved into this property at Poplar Springs. She became a playwright in Hollywood, and we actually have an original painting of her on the cover of Cosmopolitan magazine because she worked for MGM Studios, and we have it hanging on the wall as well. It was part of the original land transfers in her family from way back when King Carter and everybody, all the original land transfers. We're the second family basically to own the property, which is a little, hard to fathom actually. When we purchased the property, we didn't do much renovation. The property itself, it's a stone manor house, was in good condition, and we were able to use it right away for weddings, receptions, and social events. Building the inn and spa was a whole different ball of wax. We went through a lot to build it, and we have a 22-room inn, full-service spa, and we renovated the manor house into the restaurant. We put in HVAC and different things of that nature to make it a property that's modern and up-to-date. Over at the inn, we actually have geothermal heating and cooling, so we're trying to be a little more green as the environment's changing as well.
Well, I mean, it's drop-dead gorgeous, this property, and it just reeks of history, but still, I mean, it's really upbeat modern. What kinds of things can you do here on the property?
Well, I think one of our main things that we try to get across to our clients is come here and indulge. One of our taglines, as you might say, is indulge in our world. And indulgence is relative. Some people come here to indulge in food and wine and spa treatments. Some people come and they just want to sit by the pool and be left alone. Everybody in this day and age is going a mile a minute, driving a lot, and they need to relax and decompress. And we have a property that we feel that we can do that. And with our food, our hospitality, and a property that's in close proximity to Washington and some major metropolitan areas.
To actually interject a little personal story here, I think that the service is so extraordinary. And I'm saying this because I'm here with the ugliest big boot and a broken foot that you've seen in a long time. And everything that anybody could do for me, or anything anybody could do for me, they've done. I mean, I've been moved by golf cart from the inn to the restaurant, and it's just wonderful. You've really trained these people.
Well, as in any business, staffing is always a difficult endeavor. and always a changing endeavor. But we work really hard to train our staff to be personable and to take care of the clients. Hospitality is, you know, taking care of people. And different people want to be taken care of differently, but we're trying to train our staff to notice what's going on so they can attend to people's needs and different requirements, which there's always different requirements.
Okay, we're down to the idea we're going to have this wonderful dinner here. I mean, I've read the menu, so I have a perspective, but and what it's going to be. But I want you to say, what is your focus on the kitchen?
Well, I think, you know, being in the business, you know, from in the catering business for many, many years, and still in it, and then coming to Poplar Springs and opening a fine dining restaurant that's a la carte, a la minute type cuisine, and focusing on what you like to do, me, myself, and what type of cuisine I like. We try to, my focus, and here in the kitchen with my other chefs, is more of a classical approach. We try to put out classical cuisine with my spin. You know, things I like to do, things that are sometimes different. Sometimes, I think outside the box. I don't think too far out. Never went to culinary school. Just been working. So when you don't go to culinary school, sometimes you miss some of the things. You're able to think out of the box even a little better. So combinations and different types of things, putting them together. But I think what we try to do is put together a product that people are going to enjoy that's a little bit different, that things they don't necessarily cook at home, and they can experience here. And so far it's been fairly successful.
Now, you alluded to where you were located. Could you just expound a little bit on how to reserve here, how to get here, and that kind of thing?
Well, I think Poplar Springs is actually strategically located in a major metropolitan area, so close to Washington and Richmond. You know, I think the growth of this area is it kind of comes to us and goes all around us, and we have a little oasis and a little haven here in Casanova, Virginia. And we're actually, you know, being 50 miles from the nation's capital, a really good, quick getaway retreat, whether it's for individuals for the weekend, whether it's for corporate retreats. And what we're able to do when people are here is give them food, service, intimacy, and amenities, whether it be spa amenities, pool, tennis, yoga, special cooking classes. We also do, for some of our corporate groups, we've done some little fun, like Iron Chef competitions in the kitchen. So we really try to work with the clients and take care of them, whatever their needs are. And sometimes it's not easy for our staff. We got to run around and do things, but that's what makes it fun. If it was always the same every day, it would get a little boring.
Well, I mean, I'm really impressed with how this whole operation is run. And I think it's worth everybody who wants this kind of I don't even have it. Experience. It's upscale, but it's laid back, and it's just it's a wonderful experience. Everybody should look into it. I wanted to ask you, though, since you're also the executive chef, what kinds of things are we going to be eating tonight? Could you just give us, people like to know descriptions of dishes, if you could do that.
We're, as a restaurant, we do a lot of different menus on the property. We have menus for the inn and spa for during the day that are a little bit more health conscious. At night, what you're going to experience tonight for our dinner menu is a little bit more indulgent. I use some interesting ingredients, like I said, that people don't necessarily cook at home, whether it's foie gras. It's not banned here in Casanova, but we do things, duck breast, foie gras. You know, we have duck confit. We make some interesting soups, like we make an artichoke bisque that I think, you know, you don't find in different places. They're interesting and some combinations. But I think what we try to do really well is put together ingredients that work well. We give people their money's worth and we prepare them very well. Cooking in general in restaurants, yeah, it's up to your imagination. You can do anything. There's tons of good food out there. There's tons of interesting things to experience. And what we try to do here is in our little end of the world, put together some products that are really good and interesting entrees and items that are going to tantalize people's taste buds.
Well, listeners, I can say this. I mean, I'm looking forward to this food. I can't even tell you, and I will not exaggerate at all when I say that it's probably one of the prettiest places I've ever been in my life, in the midst of poplar forest, and the architecture, the structures, the stone walls are just so gorgeous. I mean, brilliant architecture. Wonderful ambience, and I'm expecting really great food, and your host is one heck of a guy. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, and hopefully enjoy your meal, and we'll talk, I'm sure, later this evening.
Well, Howard is an absolute delight. He also arranged to have breakfast sent to us the next morning, breakfast in bed. And Peter, all he could hear when I took the tray in was, oh, my God. And we took a photo. And, darling, can we please post that photo on our website?
I'll have to look at it and see what the quality is. But, well, we'll certainly try. Well, you'll have to take a look at it.
Let's talk about this omelet. I mean, how many people get an omelet, a large omelet, just stuffed full of great chunks of lobster and foie gras?
Well, mine on the side, which was turkey hash with eggs with hollandaise sauce, so it's sort of like a turkey hash.
They said blend of it, it was kind of like cheese grits.
It's like a turkey hash eggs benedict.
Right.
And both of them were really special, and we ate more of them than we should. But that's because we had another wine adventure ahead of us, because we moved on to a winery with a rather interesting history and a beautiful view in its own right called Old House Vineyards.
On the menus at Old House Vineyards, just outside Culpeper in central Virginia. And we're talking to Patrick Kearney. How do I explain Patrick? It's a little bit like Patrick Swayze meets Sideways as a character. We asked him, when did you buy this winery? He said 1999, I think. I said, why? Can you explain?
The winery was bought originally as a farm for the family for a hunting and fishing getaway for the folks at my office.
And you said it was Mother's Day around that time, I think you said?
It was Mother's Day, and it was actually Mother's Day of 1998. We've just celebrated our 10-year anniversary.
And what led you to the ultimate idiocy of deciding to plant wines in Virginia after Thomas Jefferson had failed 5 or 6 times?
That's a good question. I visited Old Dominion Winery on Route 29 when I first came down here, and tasted their wines, and I was thinking about planting just about 10 different vines out in front of the old house, so we'd have a nice visual, and that was going to be it.
And was the pond behind them here, so it was sort of just part of the scenery you'd look out over?
Pond was here, but since then we've expanded it into a much bigger pond with an island in the middle of it.
And don't forget the fountain, right? There's a little touch of Versailles here at Old House Vineyards as well. But you grow a number of different grapes here. Some will be familiar to listeners. Some of them might not be. So talk to us a little bit about those.
The grapes that we have here, we have Vidal, which we make 3 different wines from, a Vidal Blanc. We also do a Clover Hill, which is a dry Vidal. And we also make an ice wine. We have a Cabernet Franc, that we do a traditional Cabernet Franc as well as a rosé. We have Chamberson, which we make our Wicked Bottom.
Yeah, now, what's with the name Wicked Bottom?
Wicked Bottom was an area back in the 1700s when the town of Stevensburg was the town of York. And if you could not get into the 3 taverns in York, then you had to stay on the bottom, where there was horse racing, gambling, prostitution, cockfighting. All the best vices were in the bottom.
That was Wicked Bottom. Now, so Stevensburg was called York, and when did that get changed over?
Historically, I couldn't tell you, but it was probably 1861. It was at the intersection of the old Plank Highway and the old Carolina Highway. And so when all the presidents went up to Washington, that was a one day's travel from the town of York to Washington.
Now you've got an interesting wine that we couldn't taste, called Bacchanalia, because you don't have any of that, and another one called Petulant, but they'll be available soon, so why don't we include those in the portfolio as well?
Well, the Bacchanalia was a wine that turned out to be a big hit, and we actually sold that, out in about 3 months. It's a Meritage blend. And then the Petillant, which we will be releasing probably in about 4 weeks, is a sparkling Chardonnay.
Now, how do people get some? Do they have to come by the vineyard here? Is it out in distribution at all?
It is out in distribution just to a small amount of wine shops. But the best way to get it is to come directly to the winery, because on top of getting to taste the wines, you get the beautiful scenery and the beautiful sunsets.
And you get to talk to this comedian on wheels called Pat Kearney at the same time. A relative of his behind the bar is laughing when I said that, because this is not coming over as well as I would like in the interview. I must be doing something wrong, because he's a laugh a minute, and that's why I painted him as the character that I did in the introduction. What's in the future? Winery is not yet 10 years old. Do you have vision for the future?
The future vision for Old House is, of course, make much better wines every year and to tweak them. And Damien, our winemaker, is a fabulous winemaker, and every year his wines are better and better.
Every year his wines are better and better. Right? So no new grape varieties, nothing crazy like that. Merlot came and went.
We did just plant Petit Verdot, so we'll do a Petit Verdot as well as a Cabernet Sauvignon again.
So it's Old House Vineyards. The website is www.oldhousevineyards.com. I think the wine's also available in selected restaurants around this area as well. And several restaurant owners have said, these are really good wines. You should go there, which is why we came. So it's a good thing to look out for. If you're in Virginia Wine Month, certainly make a visit here and meet Patrick and his family and get to know them and sample as many of the wines as you can. But if you're visiting Virginia at any time, you can look for Old House Vineyard wines on restaurant wine lists, and we believe you'll enjoy them. Right, Patrick?
That's correct. Thank you.
Any last thoughts, any last words about Merlot or Vidal or Petit Verdot or anything like that you'd like to share?
Come try our Vidal. They're all great. They're all great in Virginia.
Oh, and we forgot about the wine dinners and the music concerts. So if you're in the neighborhood, tell us a little bit about those too.
The wine dinners are once a month. We do a 5-course dinner paired with wines. They're always fabulous. Also during the summer, we have summer sunset concerts where we invite everybody to come out for free and bring a picnic and just hang out and enjoy life.
And there's one tonight, so we know you've got to go turn the power on. So, Pat, thanks so much for talking to us.
Thank you very much.
And now we'll pause again. Don't touch that mouse and listen to us on the other side. We have two more interviews.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Here we are again, and we're going to do a few more interviews, two more interviews today on our adventure in Southern Virginia. Did we talk about our blog sphere yet?
Yes, we did. But okay. Just as a reminder, it's onthemenuradio.blogspot.com, so please join us.
I think that's going to be fun. Anyhow, what about Meander?
The Inn at Meander Plantation looks like it's almost been unchanged for 250 years. It's owned by two ladies, one called Susie and one called Suzanne, who had actually left for Paris that morning.
Their first time in Paris.
A modest amount of chaos ensued, but we did have the opportunity after dinner to have a nice chat with executive chef David Scales, who's quite a character in his own right. And then the next morning, we learned about special wine program the Meander Plantation is called the Virginia Wine Academy. So we'll run those interviews back to back, and I'm sure you'll find them interesting.
Executive Chef David Scales, hello.
Hello.
Now, we are at the Inn at Meander Plantation, which my husband thinks I cannot actually calculate the origin of, but I have a little note here that says that it was patented in 1727.
I thought it was 1766.
I have 1727.
Okay. Yeah, I guess I was wrong.
It's old.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it's a gorgeous property, isn't it?
Yes, it is, yes. It was built by Joshua Fries, who was the head of the House of Burgess, and Peter Jefferson, his friend.
Who was the father of?
Thomas Jefferson.
I never even thought of Thomas Jefferson as having a father. But anyhow, this is all past history. We have a lot of history here. You are in charge of this wonderful menu, which is really, you've moved this whole place into a different realm with your cooking. You came on board when?
December 10th, last year.
And you've changed the menu. What have you done?
Tripled the size of the menu, doubled the nights that were open, brought the business back, more local business, more people coming. It's like a whole new restaurant.
Now, where did you come from? You came out of the blue?
Kind of. From D.C. Moved out to Warrenton and worked at L'Auberge Provençal for about 4 months. This opportunity came up, and I was lucky enough to get the job. There's a lot of people interviewing for it, so I'm told. And, you know, I met the ladies. We kind of hit it off right off the bat. Invited them up to my house to cook the next week because they had a cooking school. The kitchen was busy, so I invited them to my home. Did a four-course meal, and right after the last course, they offered me the job.
I think you better explain what you mean by the ladies.
The owners, I call them ladies. It's Suzanne Thomas and Susie Blanchard.
Well, I mean, we had dinner here. It's a very, very edited menu. And you use a lot of local produce?
All local. Everything's local except I get some vidalias and when they're in season just because I like them. But, yeah, everything's local, 2.5 miles away. We meet with the farmer, Frank, from Retreat Farms February, pick out all the seed. And he does about 6 different eggplants for us, types of tomatoes, you name it. Just we pick everything out and we go from there. He grows our microgreens for us. They come every just for us, too. They'll come every week with the fresh microgreens. They're outside. Just snip them right before the order comes up and just keeps everything extremely fresh. Don't try to get in the way of the ingredient. Try to, you know keep as simple as possible with putting spins, you know, the sauces and other things. But that's where we kind of base our cuisine around. It's a regional modern American, I would say, and some French influences.
Only, as you know, we're basically on the menu we're talking about. Is in central and southern Virginia talking about the 20th anniversary of Wine Month. On your menu is, this is not a trick question, but it's sort of an underhanded question. I mean, you have all Virginia wines. From your extensive background, what do you think about that?
You know, when they set out doing this, that was their thing, supporting local, everything local produce, local meats, local. Cheeses, Dr. Elliott's cheeses, which are phenomenal. As wines, I like California wines. I love French wines, so I can't, it's their decision, and I respect that. But, I wouldn't mind having wines on the menu. But on the other hand, you know, there's some really, really, it's a young wine. We're young. We're like 40 years into it, but like Glendon, Rappahannock, Barbersville, their wines are really strong, and I'm kind of like winning over that as far as wine. I'm a food guy. You know, I like food first, wine second. That's just me. I'm not a sommelier. So I think it's kind of neat. I guess, otherwise I probably would have said something. But.
You're having a good time here. We had some really interesting things here. You like rich ingredients. You like foie gras, for example.
Yes, I do.
That's all you're going to say. Tell us about some of the courses we had.
I think you had the foie. It was a foie tour. It's kind of like a torchon. It was this foie, clarified butter, whip it up. Kind of cure. We did a real, real hot clarified butter. And then we emulsify that and then roll it up, set it, and it goes over veal cheeks. So it's kind of it's a great dish. Very rich, though, yes.
We decided you should teach everybody else that we've talked to about how to make veal cheeks, which yours are very good.
They are, and I'm not going to take all the credit for that. I can't take any of the credit for that because my sous chef, Matt, makes the veal cheeks. That's one of his specialties, and it's honestly one of my favorite dishes that's come out of here. The veal cheeks are brilliant. And sometimes we put them with the veal butt tender, which is also incredible. I do love that. But with the foie and the veal cheek the way it is, it was hard to tell which was where it began, where it ended. I had some before we sent it out to you.
Aha! The duck was also wonderful.
Yep, duck's slow and low. You just cook it slow on the skin, keep it crispy. Don't overcook it. Let it rest a long time so it doesn't bleed on the plate. That's about all that is, really.
Is there something that you really want to do that's like sort of off the boards in this kind of a market? I mean, like, if you had your own restaurant, what are some of the fancy dishes you'd like to put on?
It mainly would be fish. I'm big into fish, sustainable fish. And just taking fish and doing it, you know, 4 or 5 different ways on the plate. Not like a crudo thing, but cooking it 5 different ways. The same ingredients 5 different ways. And just doing that. You know, as much as you possibly fish, braise it, you poach it, sear it raw, cure, cold cure it, salt cure it. There's so many different things you can do with fish. And there's a lot of people, honestly, you can go to a lot of restaurants, cannot cook fish. And that's where I measure. When I go to a restaurant, I order fish because I want to see if they can cook it right. And usually it's overcooked or it's undercooked. It's not seasoned properly. It doesn't go with the right garnishes. That's my mark. Seasoning a soup, making a soup properly, and cooking fish is, I think, is a skill. And I pride myself on the way I cook fish. My thing around that, but jump it up, you know, a couple notches. We're out in the middle of the country here. So, I mean, like, the country is in, like, you know, or there's the mountains. So they're not, you know, but we're getting known in the area. You know, if you want to go to a great place to get food, like a great seafood/restaurant, you know, me and her has great seafood. The chef knows what to do with seafood, and I just want to take it from there and go as far as I can go.
The Manor, which are you talking about? Oh, the Meander. Okay, I'm sorry. My husband's not correct. Is there some kind of, would you like to travel someplace to explore a cuisine that you don't know about yet?
Yes. Well, we were just talking about Australia. I know about Japanese cuisine, but I've never been there. I'd love to go to Japan. I'd love to go to Provence. I'd love to go to Tuscany.
You should be really rich and not have to work at all. You could just travel and learn.
Yes. That's my next goal.
Well, you gave us a wonderful dinner, and I thank you so much, and thank you for talking to us.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure meeting you.
The Wine Academy is an interesting adjunct to the experience that you can have staying at the Inn at Meander Plantation. We've dined here, we had wine here, but we didn't get the exposure to Virginia wine that's possible through Warren Dunn, who developed a special program for the Inn at Meander Plantation called the Wine Academy. I'm just going to ask him to explain what the Wine Academy is all about.
Thank you, Peter. The Wine Academy actually started as a natural outcome of over 17 years with the Inn at Meander Plantation, which has served nothing but Virginia wines with its in its restaurant for all that time. And over that period of time, they've gained a reputation for serving not just the fine food, but pairing the food with the right wine. And also they've developed a following within the industry itself, which is very cooperative, and they encouraged us to help them make the Virginia wines a little more familiar with people, especially with their guests, by actually holding an academy, if you will. We call it an academy because school is a little intimidating, we think, in which they learn how to pair the wine with the food a little more effectively. And as a part of that process, we kind of coach them in how you can enjoy wine a little more, what type of glasses you use, what do you do, how do you open it, a bottle of wine, I mean, that basic. So we get through the basics rather quickly, and we move on. And then we hear from a wide range of vintners in the state who come and describe their wines, why they got into the business, and what their challenges are, the economics of having a vineyard and a winery. And I might add here that there's over 140 vineyards in, so we have a lot to choose from. Here at Meander, we actually have about 27 or so.
This is a several-day event. So just take us through, if you like, what would be the experience through the days of a typical wine academy?
Well, we start with a reception on Sunday evening, and that's basically a champagne reception. There are a number of vintners in Virginia that make very fine sparkling wines, and we serve those. We're not in the business of comparing one to the other, but we do serve a variety. Then on Monday morning, we start with the basics. So everybody starts off on the same foot. We just want to make sure that everybody understands what we're going to be dealing with during the 2 days that the event goes on. And then from that point on, it's up to the vintners to come in and to describe their wines. We take them out to the wineries, tour a winery. We tour from the very smallest that are almost boutique-type wineries run by hobbyists up to the largest wineries in Virginia. And we are right in the heart of the Virginia wine country. So it's an easy tour to make, and we find that the people that really enjoy watching the wine being made, and we can actually get out in the vineyards during the harvest time, and we'll have some of the vendors talk about vineyard management, what they have to do in Virginia's very humid climate to create a fine wine. So they get a full exposure as to what's involved in the Virginia wine industry.
Now, you come to wine as someone who's had a palate that was seasoned for years in Europe, because you were posted there. So, I mean, people used to laugh with me, and they would say fine British food was an oxymoron. And some people might still think wine's made in Virginia. Good wine in Virginia is an oxymoron. So dispel that myth for us.
Well, you're quite right. The Virginia reputation for making world-class wines has grown over the course of the last, perhaps 2-3 decades. And you're right, it was a very difficult thing to do because Virginia has a rather hot and humid climate. So there are certain vitis vinifera that just really don't do well here in Virginia. But what happened over that period of time is that we had a number of European firms who came to Virginia to open wineries, and also a number of European vintners. And we do have programs of exchange with Italy and with France, where they will send young graduates, if you will, of the various schools of enology there in Europe, and they work here for a while. Some of them stay. So we have quite a cross-section, a very fine winemaker. But probably what really has made the difference is a beginning in about 1980 some, there were a few vintners here who were bound and determined to develop wines that were right for Virginia as opposed for being reflective of what the better European wines were. I don't really mean that they are using the local wine grapes or anything, but they are using European wine grapes, generally speaking, but they're the lesser known ones. But they do well here, like Cabernet Franc is almost a ubiquitous grape here in Virginia because it's a large grape that grows in loose clusters, and it's easier to manage. So you will find some of the world's finest Cabernet Franc being developed here in Virginia. And then people like Dennis Horton, who perhaps is kind of the godfather of Virginia wines at the present time, he's actually introduced such varietals that are not commonly known, like Petit Mansing, like Viognier. They're well known, of course, in Europe, but they weren't well known here. So over that period of time, what happened is the Virginia vintners began to make the wines that would do well in Virginia. And they have created, I think, a class of wines that may not be entirely familiar in terms of the varietals used, but nonetheless produce an excellent world-class wine. The next item is that you really have about 140, as I've said, wineries in Virginia, but of those, probably only a dozen, if that, actually make more than 5,000 cases of wine. So what you have is basically just a familiarity problem, because most of the wines are sold through their tasting rooms, and people have to go and visit the winery and taste the wines before in the tasting room before they can really make a judgment. So yes, it's a kind of a mixed bag here in Virginia, but I'm confident over the next 20 years it's just going to explode, and I think everybody will admit that Virginia makes very world-class wines.
I'm going to ask you the final question so you have a chance to reflect on it, and then we'll come back to summarize the Wine Academy experience here at the Inn at Meander Plantation. I'm going to ask you as we close, because the On the Menu audience is truly worldwide, and nationwide in the United States. So some Virginia wines are available in broad distribution, and I'm going to ask you to identify some of those that you think are the best that people who happen to be in California or in Alaska or in New York State or New Jersey or wherever they are might have a chance to find on their winemaker shelves. Perhaps you can talk a little bit about those that you know also that have very good out-of-state shipping programs. But I want to close out on the Wine Academy itself, since we already talked to Chef David Scales. The wine experience is, of course, paired with his excellent cuisine. Am I correct? So, tell me a little bit about that, and then answer just that final question that I gave you at least 10 seconds notice of.
Quite a challenge, Peter. Well, here at Meander, we've made a practice of selecting wines, Virginia wines, that we feel could be paired with the cuisine of David Scales. And we're pretty diligent about trying to pair those wines for the various characteristics the individual varietals may have with the menu that he prepares. That can be very challenging because it has a very wide-ranging menu. So the challenge to us is to basically make certain that our guests here understand that we have a commitment to giving them the very best of Virginia wines with the very best of the cuisine in Virginia that they can get. We think we're successful at that. Yeah. Well, there's a number of wines that are available worldwide even, but basically in the United States, and the markets are largely on the East Coast. That's true for Virginia wines. But in California, for instance, I mentioned Viognier. At one time, Virginia was making more Viognier and selling more Viognier in California than California was making. Now, that's changed, obviously, over time because California was a giant when it comes to the winemaking. But essentially, there are several varietals. The Cabernet Franc I mentioned is generally available outside the state and is very popular. You have some of your Chardonnays, naturally enough. The Petit Mansing is growing, and it is not yet as big a varietal as we might. Well, the names you want to look for in terms of Virginia wines would be, as I mentioned, Dennis Horton, Horton Cellars. You'd look at Barbersville. You would look at Old House Winery. You would look at King Estates. You would look at Kluge. You would look at White House. You would look, there's 140. I'm trying to give you the very biggest wineries simply because those are the only ones that you'll find really on the shelves of the supermarket.
Well, Warren, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us. It's listeners, you don't know this, but it's actually early Sunday morning before they even serve breakfast at the Inn at Meander Plantation. So we certainly appreciate Warren arising early to take the chance to talk to us.
Well, thank you, Peter, and welcome to Virginia.
Well, you know, of course, half the fun in these places of meeting fellow guests, especially these very intimate B&Bs. I think we had over cocktails a major political discussion on the veranda. Nobody locks the doors. It was very interesting.
Yeah, it's really a charming place on a little hilltop with some beautiful views. It's the kind of place where one would have liked to linger longer, but of course, On the Menu is always on the move, bringing you new and exciting adventures, and we'll be doing the same thing, same time, same place next week, so please join us then.
Bye-bye.